Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 26th, 2000. In the fireside room this morning, we have Tom Fox. Today's session number is 2003. Today, Tom is continuing his series, Conflict Resolution, Communication, and Management. Today's title is Triggers for Conflict, or Don't Go There. Let's listen in.
No, no, you can't.
Let me start at the beginning. I won't start at the beginning. What I'd like the folks to do that haven't been here is to come on up or just hand out, we're going to hand out these three pieces of information. And then I'm going to do even a more abbreviated version. And it's going to be, you're going to be able to understand what we're talking about, but it's maybe going to be a little bit out of context for the folks who have been in the other sessions. So, there's someone who could come up here and help me put these together. We need groups of three. There we go. Keep these together. As, what is your name?
Rolf.
Oh, hi Rolf, how are you?
Hi, pleased to meet you.
Nice to see you again. We were the staff coordinators in 1990.
When we were here.
When you were here.
Yes.
Oh, that's kind of scary,
it's
isn't
all
it?
All days.
Yes.
We're just going to start, as Rolf puts these together for me, and you can start the tape. My name is Tom Fuchs, for those people who haven't been here before, or this is their first session. And I'm talking about conflict resolution and in a different way of understanding conflict. And in a way of understanding conflict that's not asking you to change your behavior. We're not asking you to change your feelings about conflict. What we're asking you to change is your thoughts and beliefs about how conflict happens. And I don't know if the gentleman is here, but I had a conversation this morning with someone who was in our session last night, and he said, last night, me and my kids, I understood homeostasis, because he must have had some sort of conflict that was happening. Is that gentleman here?
No.
No, I think he went to Stehekin. But he was talking about it in a way that really made sense. And so I'm going to really very briefly go through what we've done in the last sessions. It is our preposition that every single person really pretty much looks and handles conflict the same way. And the moment we get into conflict, we become weak and self-absorbed. We look at the other person as, scumbags and mean and rotten and nasty. And we think of ourselves as frustrated and hurt and powerless in conflict. And what we've done with this group, most of the people in this room, is we've moved through that movement. And it is a very experiential piece, but we hope that you understand that conflict happens pretty much the same for all people. That it doesn't matter whether you are 4 years old, 3 years old, or 104 years old. Basically, we all have the same way that we handle conflict. When we get into conflict, we feel confused, frustrated. If the people who are in this, that just got this, the other people have already had this, if you look at parties in conflict, we feel unsettled, confused, fearful, disorganized. And then on the bottom it says recognition and its opposites. Parties in conflict are very defensive, we're self-protective, and we're unable to look beyond our own needs. Now, that is the fundamental experience of conflict, and all people have it. And if you begin to recognize that the fundamental experience is universal, then you begin to respond to conflict differently. So, yesterday we talked about homeostasis. We believe that homeostasis is a broad band of understanding, and it's between peace and conflict. I've written it out here, it's probably a little easier. That peace and conflict, we all live on some kind of continuum between peace and conflict. And it really defines our lives. And there are certain words that we use to maintain it. And it's our values. It's our idea that we are caring and loving and competent and kind and understanding. And what were some of the other ones? People remember what their words were?
Endearing.
Trustworthy. Compassionate. All of those words really define the values of who we are. Within that homeostasis, there's also dad, mom, co-worker, all of those things.
Church member.
What's that?
Church member.
Church member. All of those things. Pastor, you know, whatever those words are. And we try our very hardest to stay in our homeostasis. We really do. And our children do. And in many ways, that's what we teach children as they grow. One, we want them to grow up to be and have really the same values as we do, which is compassion and all the trustworthiness and honesty and all of those things. And we also teach them that they don't want to come out of their homeostasis. I mean, when a kid cries, what do?
There, it'll be better.
We comfort them. We try and sort of bring them back, because we know that emotionalness is not very valued. I mean, emotions are valued, but we teach people to stay in there. So that's kind of where we've been in the last 2 days. Very abbreviated, but that's kind of where we've been.
And that a crisis takes us out of the
crisis. Absolutely. When we get into crisis, when we come out, we get so weird. And there are two reasons. One is that we've got this little part of our brain called the amygdala. The amygdala is the emotional panic button and control sensor for our frontal lobes, okay? And it's the thing that responds, chemicals pump into our bodies, blood drains out of our head, out of our chest, into our arms, into our legs, fight or flight. But there's more reasons why we begin to feel helpless when we get down and come out of our homeostasis. And empowerment and recognition is what we believe happens when you rebuild, when you try to get back into your homeostasis. Critical conflict replay. That idea that you play a conflict over how many times in your head when you have a conflict? 100, 200, 300 times. In fact, our center is beginning to do some research on how many times do we really do that? And I believe we do it over and over again. So empowerment and recognition is on that homeostasis page. Remember we said clarity about your own point of view. Empowerment always comes first. Awareness of your own needs and concerns. Feeling capable to solve the problem. And then recognition. Recognition of the understanding of the other person's point of view. Imagining how the other person might feel. And a willingness to consider the perspective of the other. And that takes strength of yourself before we can go there. Yes?
We were discussing this this morning about, I think you mentioned this last night, different people are at different levels on this scale. Mm-hmm. One person's homeostasis is not necessarily the other person's homeostasis.
Right.
We were talking about there's just some people who just seem to thrive on conflict, and in systems, you know, like congregations or offices or whatever, some people who thrive on conflict will come in and just drive everybody crazy, trying to pull them down into their...
Absolutely nuts. They will drive you absolutely nuts. And some of it has to do with what we used to do is to try and get them. You know, we've spent a lot of time trying to get them to our own homeostasis. And I believe that, and we've been more successful in organizations recognizing that everyone has one and then giving them a choice about it. Because conflict resolution used to be about getting people to sign an agreement. And we pushed everybody. We'd make them do it. And the minute you begin to make somebody do something, you may be able to get an agreement, but it's not sustainable.
I don't want to really quibble.
No, quibbling is fine.
For many years, my husband and I had foster children. Mm-hmm. Some of them stayed with us for quite a long time, but most of them were girls around 13, 14, that were with us as long as we could hold on to them, and then they would run. And the reason we got them is that we lived way out in the country, and they couldn't get back to the streets. I think that was a logical choice on the part of the agency. And it didn't take very many experiences with them to discover they were so happy to be where we were, a nice bed, warm food. No one hit them, no one was fighting. They just loved it, and they'd say, you know, how nice this is to be here. But they couldn't stand it. They needed
the
adrenaline and the excitement and the danger of the streets, mm-hmm, and the life that they'd had with their family.
Right.
And they couldn't stay. But you can't stay in a family situation. I don't know how group homes manage it, because you can't stay in a family unless you can convince its members to, in a large degree, come into your lifestyle.
Exactly, and it's not quibbling, because it fits this model. So you have a nice wife, homeostasis, and you're taking in a kid who is living a very conflictual life, may not even have a homeostasis, just a bunch of experiences, but probably has some, you know, some kind of hope that someday they'll live in a house with a bed and regular food and everything, and then you provide that. Okay? And so what you do is you say, hey, we can provide this for you. And they begin to say, they're so addicted to the chaos of the life and of the world that they cannot accept it. Okay? Now, our understanding is that that's not to say that the people that you interacted with didn't learn something. Maybe they just took a little piece that says, I know that, what is your name?
Jean.
I know that Jean's house was a place where there was a lot of chaos, or not a lot of chaos, and there was warm beds, and there was people who cared about me, and at some point, they may or may not be able to. But we've stopped forcing people into our homeostasis. In some ways, we provide a model and provide some boundaries, but you can't make anybody do anything. I was working in a very high-level mediation with counsel. In other words, they had lawyers in the room with them. Very, very much of a high-pressure organization in the United States Postal Service. Now, these two parties would start talking with each other. They'd start building empowerment and recognition. All of a sudden, the counsel would raise their hand and say, the first time it surprised the heck out of me, he said, Mr. Mediator, you know, we have settled these cases in 28 of the last 28 cases. We're ready to move to settlement. And I'd go to the parties, your counsel says you're ready to move to settlement. Are you willing to do that? They'd go, yeah. And so they would start writing out this agreement. They were kind of coming to an agreement. And the agreement became really, really long. And there were a lot of words to define the agreement. And they kept having to go more and more technical because there wasn't any empowerment and recognition built. And then they would get more and more technical, and the agreement started to get really, really long. And then all of a sudden the parties would say, wait a minute. You know, before we go any further, I want to talk about what you said to me and how I felt about that. And then they would start building empowerment and recognition. And it would go on for 20 or 30 minutes. And all of a sudden the council would say, you know, let's get back to the business. You know, and it was like, I started to shake my head, you know. But I follow the parties, you know. I said, okay, you know, how do the parties feel? The parties said, okay, we can go back. They'd go back to the agreement. Once again, they churn out these really long words, and there's all these stipulations because they didn't trust each other. And then all of a sudden, one guy said to the other guy, well, you know that comment you made to me, and this had to do with a racial thing. He said, I want to talk about what you perceived me to say, and da-da-da-da-da. And so they'd go right back into building empowerment and recognition. In other words, if we allow it to happen, if people come out of their homeostasis, and if we allow that empowerment and recognition, and what we do as mediators is we foster it. We foster those opportunities. We do paraphrasing. We do listening. We do bridging of ideas. We ask good questions, hard questions. You know, we're not a potted plant, you know. We avoid that kumbaya moment. That's what we call it. Like, no, I mean, how many people have that experience in conflict resolution? Conflict is a dynamic, ongoing part of our lives. It's a necessary part. And I'm not here to tell you that we can eliminate conflict. In fact, I think it's the worst thing we could do.
I'm thinking about this course I took in self-protection, what's that called, self-defense. Mm-hmm. And their training, especially for women, was that when you feel your adrenaline pumping, instead of going into that state of powerlessness, like if you're being attacked, mm-hmm. that you just use all that adrenaline you have to just become empowered and fight back. And you have these words in your head that, and I still remember my words, somebody attacks me, I know exactly what I'm going to think, and I'm like, you know, really. But I'm wondering if in the kind of situation where you're not in a physical conflict, where you really do have to physically defend yourself or your children, are there ways to make use of that adrenaline, or do you try to diffuse it and disperse the adrenaline before you can really get to meaningful work?
And that's exactly where we're going. So it's a great lead into the next session that I'm going to talk about. Is there any question about where we've been? One of the things that our organization does is that we've been really on the cutting edge of creating training that changes people in organizations. You know, we used to do a lot of training mediators, and now we go in and talk more about conflict management between everyone. And I think that that's such a nice way of looking at one of the things that we found out, we did conflict resolution in schools. And they did a lot of research on conflict resolution in schools. They taught people to be mediators. And they found out that the people who really benefited most from peer mediation programs were the mediators. So we've sort of taken that one step further and said, no, we're willing to do training on creating conflict management. Go ahead.
So do you find that your role sometimes is that you have to destabilize
a kumbaya moment?
Right.
Oftentimes, here's how mediation standard mediation goes, is you start working, you start building in power, fostering empowerment and recognition, they sort of get on the bandwagon, and then all of a sudden they hit this sort of this kumbaya thing where everything sort of is falling into place. And the orientation tends to be that once that starts to happen, it's like, whew, you know, for the mediators and for the participants, because we all want to live in our homeostasis. I mean, that's what we rely on. That people want to get back to where they were. They want to feel themselves as competent, capable people. Capable? Capable people. But we go in there and we start to test the decisions and we don't let it just get glossed over. Oh well, we'll talk about that when it comes up. I mean, to me, that's like red flags. I say, let's talk about how are you going to talk about it when that comes up. Who's going to bring it up? So a job as a mediator is to sort of make sure that it's not just this real kind of nebulous, let's all just get along.
So would you say then that you actually strive sometimes to bring groups out of their homeostasis? A little conflict.
We don't ever have to worry about them. They're already out when they reach us. We're guaranteed of that. What we do is we don't allow false building of empowerment and recognition. Okay? Kind of that. And we've all been that place where it really starts going well, and it's just like, oh, this feels good, you know? And then nobody wants to break that little kind of bridging that's going on. You know, it's like when you're in a marriage and you're kind of rebuilding that stuff, and you know that sometimes it's going to fall back down again and you have to continue to rebuild. So, yeah, maybe we bring them back down a little, but we always think it's like reality testing, and it's ultimately a better response. We're going to talk about four core identities and a sense of self today. This comes from Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most. This is put out by the Harvard Negotiation Project. Harvard Negotiation Project, easy, you got the hat. Jerry's got the hat on. Harvard Negotiation Project were the first people that really came up with an understanding of what do mediators do. And it was very economic and problem-based. It was all about solving the problem. It had nothing to do with what homeostasis are and everything else. And once this concept came out with empowerment and recognition and understanding those components, then Harvard came out with this idea about discussing what matters most. And I really like this core identities, because anytime you get triggered, something is at work. And probably one of these core identities are at work and are being challenged. In other words, something's happening that's sort of pulling you out of your homeostasis. One of your core identities is getting tweaked. I've got a great story. Is Ingrid here? Ingrid Christiansen? I probably should tell her this before I tell it to you, but I promise I'll tell her. I was here in 1986, and not a new person in faith, grew up in a Catholic church, had kind of, actually I think this was my first real kind of involvement with Lutherans, and I was here for 5 weeks on staff, and I offered to do a matins. And I was real shaky because my faith had yet to kind of sort of come into bloom and really be developed. And I did a matins, and it was a powerful matins. It was a good for me, and I spent a lot of time. I spent 4 or 5 hours really digging in the Bible and doing it. And the unfortunate part was that I didn't find an inclusive Bible. Okay. I found, I don't know if it was King James or New King James, I'm not sure what it was, but it didn't use inclusive language for talking about God and God's people. It was men. And the matins was powerful, and people came up to me afterwards and said, great message, you know, really good stuff. And Ingrid came up to me and said, and I'm sure today that I would have just accepted it, but at the time, my homeostasis was pretty fragile. You know, this was a new experience for me, and I was right there. And she said something to me about inclusive language, like, are you going to include women in this too? You know, and absolutely destroyed me. Threw me out of my homeostasis because I was pretty fragile. And I'm not sure she knew that I was fragile because I'm sure the message was pretty powerful. So I came out, and it took me about 2 or 3 years to sort of even consider using inclusive language again. You know what I mean? I because it was like I had this real negative connection to it. Like, if you can do that and not consider me, what's going on here? So, and I haven't told Ingrid, so please don't tell her she'll like it to tell her. But that idea that she sort of affected, if you look at it, my competence. You know, am I competent to do the job of matins? She sort of affected, am I a good person? Do good people use inclusive language? In her mind, certainly. And at my mind, I was just beginning to accept the idea of inclusive language. I mean, I have since come around pretty well, I think. But, you know, that's that whole idea. Am I worthy of love? Yeah. So anytime we come out of our homeostasis, we get affected by one of those core identities. Let's see, I'll give you another example. Oh, I told the story of my daughter, and I was getting her to, I was running an errand, and she wanted to not go on the errand, then she wanted to go on the errand, and not go on the errand, and go on the errand, and finally I said, you have to go, and I ended up having to push her into the van. She's like hooked her arms on the edge of the van, and I'm pushing her in there, and then she tried to jump out of the van as it was moving down the road. Now think about that, and I got completely out of control. I mean, I'm starting to scream and yell, but look at that. Am I competent as a parent? Do competent parents let their children jump out of vans? Am I a good person? Do good people let anybody jump out of vans? Am I worthy of love? If you love your children, do you let them jump out of vans? No. And the last one is autonomy. I only wanted to just do the errand. I mean, that's all I wanted to do, and then all of a sudden I have this huge fight on my hands with my 7 or 6 year old daughter at the time. And how come I can't just act as an autonomous person? So she was affecting my autonomy too.
As you were affecting hers.
As I was affecting hers, exactly. Because you know what? She has a homeostasis just like I do. And I was affecting her homeostasis. And as parents, we get to choose. From this day forward, all of you get to choose about, are you going to affect somebody's homeostasis? I lived at Holman Village from 1989 to 1991. Whenever I come back, I sort of see things that aren't the same. and I think I used to think, it's like, I used to have to go tell somebody that they weren't the same. Jerry,
we've all been there.
Jerry was here in 1965. Is it the same? That's a pretty funny thing to think about, you know? I mean, that we should think that Holden Village has to be the same place. And if it was the same place, would it have the magic that it has for us? So, does that make sense? So, I would always sort of kind of want to come and sort of trigger people And that's what I knew what I would be doing. If I ran up to another staff person now and said, well, you know, back in 1989 when I was the staff coordinator, immediately it creates a conflict for them because I'm saying, you aren't doing it right. You're not doing it the way you should be doing it. So I have to look at it differently today than I did before I knew these things. So we all have these identities working in our homeostasis. Confidence. Am I a good person? Am I worthy of love? And do I have autonomy to act the way I want to act? And the minute something changes, something happens, you know? And if we understand those triggers, if we understand our core identities, if we understand our triggers, then we're more able to respond to and understand whether or not, and choosing whether or not we're going to come out of our homeostasis. I want to talk about two vulnerable aspects of identity, and if you look at that, one is clinging purely to a positive identity, leaving no place in our self-concept for a negative feedback. I have a sister, absolutely love her. She is a licensed social work therapist. Incredible woman, recovering. She has a teen daughter. And I watched this teen daughter, and this teen daughter is an intelligent child. In eighth grade, she passed her SATs that would allow her into any university in the United States. Any university, I mean, that's how smart she is. But all of a sudden, I noticed some real bizarre behavior changes. I mean, really these absolutely bell pants about this big and multiple ear face piercings and dog collars. And I'm just like, to my sister, I'm like, Susie, what's going on here? Oh, she's just going through a phase. And I'm like, no, she's doping. I mean, she's using marijuana. And oh no, she's a good kid. She's getting good grades. I'm like, okay. You know, and then I saw her with her boyfriend, and the guy could have been wearing a sign above his head that I smoke dope. I mean, that's a lot of us to me. I mean, he walked in the room, and I'm just like, and I come from some of that background, so I can pretty much identify them when they come in the room. And I said to my sister, that guy looks like a doper. And she goes, no, he's on the bowling team. So I'm like, okay, you know, and she was really in denial. And so when we get into a state of denial where we can't take any kind of, because that sort of feedback was directly placed on her as a competent mother. Look at that identity, those core identities. It was her competency as a mom. And so she wasn't able to sort of look at the handwriting on the wall. We do this over and over in our lives. We do it over and over in our lives. We sort of protect ourselves. And we don't allow anybody to say, something's going on. Something's happening. Okay? And finally, surprises of surprises. She got into trouble. They did a blood test, and she had multiple chemicals in her system. And it's like, yeah, duh. You know, but I couldn't go back then and say, told you so, I told you so. Even though she's my sister and I'd love to do that, it wouldn't have been helpful for her homeostasis. Okay? So I called her up and I said, you know, how can I help? And we kind of got through that. But she denied all of that feedback. And that's what we tend to kind of do that in our lives. You know, at Holden Village, we tend to not take a lot of opportunities to look at evangelicalness. Okay? We tend to look at the left side of it, but we don't allow a lot of our opportunities to sort of examine the full spectrum of spirituality. You know? And that has to do with a homeostasis that the village has. Because that challenges us. I'm not saying that tomorrow we should rush out and do that, but I think as an organization, we have to look at what kind of perspectives are we listening to. The other one, does everybody understand denial? Denial happens to us in the most subtle ways. Now, if you look at that, it says the bigger gap between what we hope is true and what we fear is true, the easier it is for us to be affected by the fundamental experience of conflict. In other words, when my sister finally figured out that this was going on, she really had a pretty serious fall out of her homeostasis because she had been denied for such a long time. And then it was like, boom. Another example, a friend of mine was in a marriage for 11 years and really always played the good wife. And I would go over to their house and it would always be kind of this little tension. And a couple times I said, is everything okay? Yeah, everything's just fine. And then all of a sudden, one day she came to me and she was just really in tears and she talked about an emotional affair that she had with this other person. And she said, you know, I just never recognized it. I didn't know this could ever happen to me, because she was very rigid about staying in marriage and everything else, and thought that, you know, relationships, extramarital relationships, were part of somebody else's experience, not her own. And so she had a very major fall out of her homeostasis because she was so much in denial of her own humanness. The second one is exaggeration. Placing all self-concept identities based on the all or nothing continuum. We had an administrative assistant at the Conflict Resolution Center who was great at this. It was like, this woman could do anything. She types 120 words a minute. She was an accountant. She did it all. You asked her, she was there. And everything was just fine until you said, oh, Janice, there's a typo here. And it's like, oh, I'm a bad person. I'm a terrible person. Oh, just whip me, beat me. And it's all those kind of, you know how that goes. We know those people in our lives, don't we? It's like, I'm a good person, and I do not let anybody sort of think about the negative components or what might be the dirty laundry in my life, because I want everybody to think that I'm a great person. And that's another one, that allowing other people's feedback to define who we are. I mean, I think that an important component of homeostasis is understanding that we have both positive and negative components in there, and we fail regularly, and we've got a great model. I mean, it's a great understanding, you know, of forgiveness and all those other components that we have in our faith. That's the human side of it. So, exaggeration is the other one. What's weird about exaggeration is that in some organizations, when someone does that, what we do is we tend to cocoon them. And we cocoon that person, and we simply begin to go around them. If we don't believe somebody's good at, it happened with this administrative assistant. I have another coworker who, because the woman would do typos at 120 words a minute, began to do and would not receive any critical feedback. She started to go around her and not allow the administrative assistant to do her job. So she did all her own handouts. She did all of her own letters. And we wrap people. And they don't know why they stand there, but they don't know why, because no one's giving them any feedback, because if you give them any feedback, then all of a sudden, oh, I'm a bad person, and I come out of that. Are you following me on this? Okay, here's what I want you to do. We all have triggers for our identity, and our identity is about our homeostasis. And there are certain triggers which pull us out. An example would be that inclusive language explanation I just had. You know, there was something about my newness and my not willingness to hear that message that sort of triggered me because I was so new. Another example, I'm a lousy speller. You know that now. You've been in my sessions before. But because I know that that's a trigger for me, I make fun of it in the beginning so it doesn't catch me on the backside. You know, the worst thing for me is to be spelling something, spell it wrong, and all of a sudden somebody raise their hands, you spelled that wrong. And then I feel like, ah! Kind of, because that's about my competency as a presenter. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to split you up into groups. I'm going to have you get into groups of 4, 5, 6. And I want you to talk about triggers. What are the triggers as people in our jobs and in our personal life? Let's see, another example of a trigger. Does anybody have an example of a trigger?
Being on time.
Yep, right. Some people, I'm a person who I have to be on time. Are you?
Yeah.
I would rather be 10 minutes early than 1 minute late. And it's a great trigger, great example. And so in my family, I have two daughters and my wife who don't really have that same orientation to the world. And I noticed that, and a lot of these triggers come from our home life and the way we grew up. And I grew up in a family of seven kids. And I always sat in the front row because that was the only one left by the time our family got there, okay? And so I just remembered all that sort of stuff. And that is a trigger for me, and it sounds like it's a trigger for you. Yep. And that trigger, sometimes, if we allow it, can pull us out of our homeostasis. I mean, I can, sometimes I'm like, come on, let's get going, you know, it's 4 minutes to church, you know, and I'm getting all the people going, or, you know. And what I've done, since I understand this a little bit more, is to say, we now have 5 minutes. I'm going to grab a cup of coffee. I'll meet you in the car. And I've been able to sort of work through that because... So, what are your triggers? For pastors, a trigger might be, we've never done it that way before.
Seven last words of the church.
That's right. What would be another one? What would be a trigger? Another trigger. Go ahead.
Teachers.
Oh, teacher.
God, this is boring.
God, this is boring. Yeah. Yeah. It's those phrasing and those words that sort of just tweak us, you know, and get us defensive. I want you guys to come up in groups of six or seven, whatever. Come up with lists for personal life and work life of what are those triggers. Does that make sense, what I want you to do? That's the first part. The second part is, what are the patterns of loss of homeostasis for you? What happens when you come out of your homeostasis? That's a pretty interesting thing to think about. What happens when you get kind of on that edge, you know, and you're like this? I begin to get more quiet. You know, I'm very vocal. But when I get into conflict, I get more quiet. What do? When I get into conflict that's kind of building, I begin to wake up two or three times at night and racing thoughts. Okay? That's a pattern of loss for me that I've been able to recognize now, and it's not as powerful. Okay? So, another pattern of loss. I get belligerent. You know? I want to speak a lot of truth to power, sometimes very stupidly.
Target.
So does that make sense what I want you to do? Just those two things. What are your triggers, generally? And then what are your patterns of loss? So go ahead, just break up into groups. Turn around your chairs. Introduce yourself first so you kind of know who you are. I'll give you about 5 minutes. About 5 minutes. You can stop the tape for 5 minutes. What's one of the triggers you came up with?
You don't care.
Okay. So is this a parent-child piece?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a pastor piece.
It's a pastor piece. Sometimes it's a work piece, but you don't care. Right. I don't know if I'll be able to write, but right. You don't care.
I'll write.
Will you? Excellent. Thank you.
I haven't bended a backboard.
There you go. You don't care. Why is you don't care a trigger? What competency does it affect, or what identity does it hit us?
Am I a good person?
Am I capable? Exactly. Good. Next one. Over here, trigger. Yeah.
When our honesty or integrity is questioned.
Exactly. When our honesty or integrity is questioned, and you want to see people jump, question their integrity. You twitch, don't you? And that's what happens. This group over here?
Name called.
Yeah. What kind of names do you want to be called?
Not stupid.
Not poopy pants.
Yeah, poopy butt. Sure, poopy pants, whatever it is, right? Not stupid. This group here?
People not listening to you.
People not listening to you. If I could do anything to, you know, I try to stay away from techniques and problem solving and conflicts, but if there's one thing that I would encourage any party to do when there's a conflict is to sit down and to try and listen to the other person before it goes too far. Because once you come out of your homeostasis, when the blood drains out of your head, it also drains out of your ears. And your ability to hear it, because your defensiveness go sky high. And so people not listening. And once they're not listening, then you become not listening. And
you know. Oh, and the flip side is like, you're not listening to me.
Right. That's right, and you're not listening to me. And we just go trigger each other. Go ahead.
Micromanaging.
Okay, micromanaging. Yeah. When someone comes and tells you how it should be done or how you're not doing it right. Right. Which is one of the issues which why I don't go up to people at Holden Village and say, back in 89. Because in many ways, it's their community. I'm part of this community, but right now it's
especially
their.
When you've been hired for your competency.
Yeah.
Then what's that all about?
Yeah, what is that all about? Yeah, right. Give me the opportunity to be, and it's like autonomy is major, yes. Major piece there, isn't it?
Being good. Interrupted.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Also part of that listening skill when someone's constantly interrupting you because they know better. Did I hit all the ones on this side? Okay.
An implication something could be done better. Why don't we, or what? Why shouldn't it be done this way or that? And that the implication being you're not doing it right.
You're not doing it right, so it's, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Good, inferring. Excellent. This group, right here.
You don't know what you're doing.
You don't know what you're doing?
Yes, you don't really know what you're doing.
Right, you don't know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Smarten up. Exactly. This group?
Not being treated equitably in a work situation.
Right. Right. Anytime we believe that the world that we live in is not equitable, and somehow we're on the disproportionate side of equitability, in other words, we're not being treated equals, we tend to get our defenses up. Case in point, right?
When people don't follow through.
Okay, say more about that.
Say more about that.
Was that the
you
last
say this again, don't you? I supervise about 55 or 60 coaches, and we have an extensive, and we have so many teams that we have to practice off campus and do this and that, and we hire buses for this. And now and again, a person will decide not to have practice or the game gets canceled, but they neglect to tell the secretary to cancel the bus. And so the bus sits there waiting for this team and then drives off and we have to pay for the bus even though we never used it. It's just, ugh! Choke these people.
Yes.
The newsletter articles don't come in on time, and so the volunteer that's putting the newsletter together can't get her work done, so the secretary can't get it printed, so it can't get to the post office on time, so.
And so, right, because they're relying on other people. You have another one over in this group?
Tone of voice. Negative.
Bad. Condescending.
Whining.
Another one that gets adults is parent-child. If you are adult-to-adult and somebody else says, well, why didn't you do that? You're just like, you know, you get that kind of, that immediately you get that defensiveness that comes up. That's a trigger. I mean, you're getting triggered. You're getting pushed. So, yeah, condescending, any kind of tone of voice, parent-child communication. You have another one?
Anything else from our list?
Okay, that's fine.
The group is covered at Holis beautifully.
What's that?
The group is covered at Holis beautifully.
That's right.
Yeah, good.
When
somebody shoves you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, shooting on people. You shouldn't shoot on yourself, right? Exactly. Yeah? Well, should implies I know better than you and you aren't doing it the way it needs to be done.
People who have to be on time.
And there's a cultural context to that. And there, we recognize that there is a cultural context. In some cultures... within a day or two, I mean...
Inshallah.
What's that?
Inshallah.
Inshallah?
All of the Middle East, inshallah, means in God's time.
In
that
God's time.
Today, tomorrow, next year, inshallah.
Yes. Mañana, tomorrow, mañana. Okay, another one from over here? Anywhere? Any big ones we've missed?
Some body languages.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Body language. Intuitively, well, we're going to talk about emotional intelligence. I don't know how many of you are going to be here next week, but we're going to talk about emotional intelligence and the fact that 90% of all emotional language is nonverbal. And body language plays an important part in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, three more that aren't
full. Go ahead.
Hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
Can do it for me.
Absolutely. I'll turn the spell check on.
When someone criticizes my kids.
Oh, yeah. Or criticizes you as a parent. Yeah, you're a bad parent.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Can't be. People who are locked into the rules.
So, absolutely rigid thinking. The law, not the gospel, the law. Absolutely. No, go ahead. I'm just looking into the light here.
When there is no body, absence of body language bothers me tremendously because email or phone calls, when I feel like I can't tell what's going on with that person, mm-hmm. I don't know what context to put it in at all. Mm-hmm. And so then I start to think, well, what if they really meant such and such? Because I have nothing to help me with it.
We did a...
go ahead. I was just wondering, is that particularly true with people with whom you've had conflicts in the past?
I don't know.
I know it is for me, so...
We did a mediation one time where they were fighting with each other over email. It finally got down. It was one of the easily solved mediations I've ever been in. The woman typed all her emails in capital letters.
This means you're screaming.
And everybody thought she was screaming at her, at everybody. And they were all really mad at it. And no one was willing to sort of go to her and say, stop screaming at me. And the woman said, I just do it because it's easier. You know, there wasn't a lot of malice in there. And so, you know, sometimes we have to think about, we end up in our organization dealing a lot more with people who are trying to manage each other by email, and it is not really any better than trying to manage each other by regular mail. You know, would you send a regular mail to somebody and, you know, do this sort of thing? So, yeah, email has become a whole new way of pissing each other off. It really has. I'm sorry, there's my little jadedness coming out.
I have one thing to add to the list.
Okay.
I get really upset when I'm trying to express to somebody how I'm feeling about something, and they don't acknowledge what I'm saying before they start explaining themselves, and then they just go on and on about their mm-hmm. own perspective.
So rebuttal.
And so I feel like I'm not being heard, whether they hear me or not. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm not being heard.
Mm-hmm. So it's like rebuttal building. They're already thinking about what they're going to say, not really listening to what you are saying, but always going.
Or maybe they do hear what I'm saying. They're just, instead of saying, oh, you're saying this, they just go on with their viewpoint.
Right.
Instead of saying, I see where you're coming from, and saying that they see it.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like, whether they see it or not, if they don't make it known verbally out loud that they see where I'm going and then go into where they come from, I just, it drives me crazy because I feel like they're not they're just all concerned about them and not
about, right, about their own kind of point of view and everything about them, but nothing.
It's all about them and it's not all about them. Yeah.
Or getting no response at all.
Oh yeah.
Or denial of your feelings. You know, you say, I feel wrong.
Don't feel that way.
Right? Or fix it.
Yeah.
So, oh, here's what you can do about that.
Oh, yeah. Over and over again, as I incorporated this orientation towards conflict, and as we've taught it, I do much less fixing. Okay? Because, you know, this is a fairly optimistic view of how people understand conflict. What we say is that people are capable. It's our premise. The people are capable of solving their own problems. It is the momentary confusion and conflict that's creating the miscommunication and everything else. They know how to solve the problem. All we need to do is foster empowerment and recognition, and they'll get to it. But if I come in and say, this is the way you solve it, then it's my idea and not theirs. An example, my daughter Jillian comes home one day and she's like, oh, Becca's all mad at me. And I'm like, well, tell me more. Oh, I was supposed to go over to Becca's house, but I didn't want to go to Becca's house, so I went to Jean's house. And then Becca called here and Mom told her that, you know, it's that seventh grade sort of thing, you know. And I told Mom to tell her that I wasn't at Jean's house and da-da-da-da-da. You know, it was about lying, and it was about being truthful, about being honest. And I wanted to say all those things. You know, you shouldn't lie. I wanted to plant my homeostasis in my daughter. And I just kept saying, tell me more. So this is what it's about. I just paraphrased it. And finally, after about 5 minutes of this, I said, you know, how can I help you? And she said, you know, I don't think you really can. I just wanted you to hear it. And isn't that a much nicer way? That's cool. And she said, you know, and I really, I don't, she said, you know, I probably need to be honest about this. If I didn't want to go to Becca's house, I probably needed to tell her, and I'm like, right on. Because that's my homeostasis.
Two thoughts, completely different. Things that trigger me are when people say, I tell them something, and they say, well, that's nothing. or I've got a better
one. One-upsmanship. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I got a better story.
But I want to get back to what you just said. I think it's some sexist, but it might be a male-female thing. I think there should be a rule that when two people talk, you and I get into this all the time, that you're telling them, I'm hearing something, and then there should just be a rule to say, are we in a fix-it mode or a just listening mode? And, you know, so if we're in a fix-it mode, then I can fix it. If we're in a listening mode, then I'll just listen. But it's often, I'm fixing, and she wants me to listen.
there is a male.
Most guys I talk to get into that trouble. I tried to fix this, and I just got myself into trouble.
It's a Mars-Venus thing.
Yeah. It really is.
It's a Mars-Venus thing. There is some.
The flip side of that is, what do you want me to do about it? You know, where the guy feels that, you know, you're expecting to fix it.
Right. We are. Yeah, we don't. I mean, I think it's might be a little bit of a generalization, but men are into that orientation about, how do you fix it? Because overwhelmingly, men are not feeling F people. In fact, in our society, and they've done tests now on personality, where it's only 20% of all men have a stronger feeling component than a thinking component.
Only 20%?
20% of men. So,
most of a lot was taught.
Yeah, well, a lot is taught, and I think we can be different. I mean, I think that men, you know, we're going to talk about some gender differences when we talk about, we're going to talk about the role of emotional intelligence, and we're going to talk about those components. We're actually over our time, and I want to thank you for coming, and we'll see you next time.